have the false belief that much of what we face today as Americans, as a species, are somewhat new problems, or due in large part to modern industrialization. But what if I told you that most of the root problems from which stem our current epidemics and outright catastrophes were not only created by one group, one family even, but were planned and orchestrated to deliver a few elite groups monumental wealth while systematically subjugating and manipulating the average population with design to ultimately provide what has now become their final destination, dominion over the world itself. Here to discuss this and his new documentary, Why Big Oil Conquered the World, is James Corbett. Welcome, James.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. I'm happy to be here to talk about what I think is one of the most important issues facing humanity.
And I absolutely could not agree more. It's a very profound documentary. It really dives into some information that is really surprising. I think that's the first thing that stands out to me, is that it's absolutely amazing how little we know about our own history in this country and the world most likely as well. But for instance, the idea that the first electric car was invented in 1984, or even that 28% of the cars in 1987 were electric cars. I mean, that blew my mind.
Yes, 1894 and 1897. Yes, exactly. So it's right. It's over 120 years old technology at this point, and was suppressed. Absolutely. That technology was suppressed because it represented something that was not in tune with the oligarchical idea, which is monopolization. Monopolization of wealth, monopolization of resources has always been the goal and has always been one of the key points of all of this, which is why it should be no surprise that I frame this documentary around big oil, the oil industry, because it represents the ultimate move in that game of monopolization. If you can monopolize an energy resource, the key energy resource of the 20th century, and exclude all competition or all would-be competitors for that resource being the key linchpin of the modern industrial economy, you have effectively control over the planet. And that's, I think, the bigger picture of what I'm trying to paint here.
And a great example of that is when you touch on the ethanol aspect of it. And one another thing that totally shocked me was finding out that it was the reasons for prohibition, in essence, you know, rather one of the most influential reasons behind it. And that ethanol after that was actually poisoned with petroleum, of all things. It's just perfect. It just lines up just great.
Yes. There's so many things like that you have to scratch your head and wonder. I mean, it's just so in your face when you are able to connect those pieces. Another one that didn't fit into the documentary, but that I just wrote about in my newsletter, is about a documentary. I used a little clip of it in Why Big Oil Conquered the World. It's called Survival of Spaceship Earth. And it's this bizarre 1972 UN United Nations Enviroganda propaganda flick about the population crisis and pollution and all of this and how it's all coming together. And it's a strange documentary in a number of ways. But one thing that's really stuck out to me when I was first watching it was, well, of course, technology can be part of the answer to the problems that are being caused by, you know, too many people and strains on the Earth's resources and all of this. And one thing we can do is we can stabilize the soil with oil. Of course, with oil. Oil technology is going to save the day. It's always coming back to that. And it seems to constantly fit itself into a lot of different agendas.
Yeah, most definitely. And this really begins to seem like kind of like the pinnacle of all conspiracies kind of like bundled into one. And it makes it hard for a lot of people to really wrap their mind around, because when you watch these, it really begins to lay, you just kind of see everything falling into place. How it all seems to connect back to this larger story. What would you say is the most shocking aspect to you that while going through all this research, what was a part of it that surprised you, that really stuck with you, that you didn't know before doing it?
It's difficult to say, because I really have been, in one sense or another, researching this for the past decade. I mean, I've talked about the Rockefeller family, I've talked about eugenics and climate change and all of this over the course of the last 10 years. So it's not new information to me in that sense, but something that really stuck out when I was putting this documentary together on Why Big Oil Conquered the World, I was going back over the eugenics information, the history of eugenics, its rise in the early 20th century. And it struck me the reality of this. I mean, this isn't some sort of vague concept that you can kind of interpret this way, or no, these were people who genuinely believed that they were genetically superior, and probably still do believe this, and genuinely believe that gave them the right to rule over other human beings and decide who gets to pass on their genes and who is not fit to pass on their genes. That was a genuinely and fervently held belief, not just by a small group of the elite, but by a lot of people in society a century ago, to the point where you had the fitter family contests and all of these things, you know, who can be the most eugenically sound, and people, you know, volunteering to get eugenically tested to see if they're worthy of passing on their genes and all of this. And every aspect of our modern day life, or so many aspects of our modern day life at any rate, have come from that mindset, to the point where we don't even know. People don't know why they get a marriage license. It is because you are being tested by the state for your eugenical value in passing on your... This is where it comes from. Of course, that's all been dropped, and we don't really think of that aspect of it. But why do you get blood tests and things if you're going to get married? What on earth is this about? Oh, right, it's about eugenics. It all comes back to this. And this so undergirds and underlies so many of the systems of control that we take for granted nowadays, that you can take away that fundamental justification, the justification of the genetically superior or whatever, and people still go along with those structures that were created around it. And that reality of that history that still is with us, even though we don't see it anymore, is what really struck me when I was going through the research this time.
That's very interesting. You know, I often ask while researching or even watching a documentary when they touch on eugenics and other topics like this, and when considering families or groups like the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, and whether or not they actually believe these things. And you touched on that right there, that they, you know, you believe that they truly believe in the eugenic aspect, that they're superior, the whole superior race aspect. But I wonder, as a perfect example is prohibition and how I don't believe that they thought it was a moral aspect. I don't think that prohibition was a problem for them. They used it for political purposes, right? So I often wonder how much that ties in and if they do genuinely feel that way about eugenics. But it does begin to seem that way when you really see how it plays out. On the eugenics aspect, now that we're talking about it, how much do you feel it plays in with what we saw happen in World War II with the Nazi agenda? Because you talked about how there was actual funding for the basically the research that led to that. But how much do you feel there was actual either influence or connection with what we saw with the eugenics program in Germany and the Nazis?
Right. And again, this isn't something we have to speculate about. As I pointed out, the eugenic sterilization law that was passed in Germany 6 months after Hitler became chancellor was deliberately and consciously modeled on the draft legislation that had been drafted by Henry Laughlin, the associate of Charles Davenport, the co-founder of the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, the center of American eugenics. He drafted this example legislation that he hoped would be used in various states around the United States, and ultimately became the example model for the law that became the standard in the Buck v. Bell case that paved the way towards general legalization of forced sterilization in the United States. The Nazis deliberately modeled their eugenic sterilization law on that law that was drafted by Laughlin. That's a direct, undeniable connection. And then, of course, as you say, there's all the funding that came from the Rockefellers, the Rockefeller Foundation, that was, interestingly, was being done through their international offices. It was going through Paris and everything, because even at that time, even in that early stage in the late 20s, early 30s, or in the early part of the 1930s anyway, they knew that this was controversial, that maybe they shouldn't be seen to be giving this money out. So they were doing it through their Paris offices and other organs, but they were without that funding. There is no doubt that the Kaiser Wilhelm Institutes, which included an institute for the study of eugenics, would not have been able to function in the way that they did. This was an incredibly important injection of funds at an incredibly important time that funded that research. And there's a direct connection there.
So how would you think that ties in with a lot of, I mean, you could call it current research, but I think it's been around for a while. I mean, these ideas how we understand the war, World War II and the fighting Germany, how that the idea that essentially that Hitler was trying to fight globalism, and that's kind of like this new, as it pertains to what we're seeing today, and how that plays in with the eugenics aspect. The eugenics aspect. What do you think about that?
Right. Yes. The Hitler was against the banksters idea, which is certainly in vogue right now, and I think misses the fundamental point, which was that Hitler was a creation of the banksters. And to the extent that he was a witting participant in that, and to the extent that he was just a useful pawn, I think is deliberable and probably involves parts of the story, like Rudolf Hess flying into Scotland saying, "Hey guys, we had a deal. What are you guys doing? You know, we're supposed to, you know, we let you go at Dunkirk, you know, fair play, tit for tat," right? Clearly, I think there is something going on behind the scenes there, and obviously related to the royal family in England, who clearly were openly supportive of Nazis, which is why the king actually abdicated. Not so much about the divorcee aspect of it. But anyway, at any rate, Hitler and the Nazis were allowed to exist, at any rate, because of the banking connections through the Bank for International Settlements, which was actually created in the 30s as part of the ability to get Germany to conform to, in some way, to the reparations for World War I, that whole debacle. And it was through that they were able to connect out to the broader international financial system. And that continued throughout the war because the Bank for International Settlements, of course, is its own thing. Its headquarters is in Basel, Switzerland, but it's not in Swiss territory. It's its own territory. It's one of those kinds of organizations where the Swiss police have to knock on the door and ask for permission to enter. So clearly there was a banking and international infrastructure which allowed Germany to function financially. And then when you look at Anthony Sutton did the exhaustive research on the interlocks between the corporations, the corporate aspect of primarily American Wall Street backed institutions and corporations and the Nazi war machine, which wouldn't have been possible without the direct injection of funds and technology from the West, including, of course, the fact that Germany didn't have oil of its own. How is it going to create gasoline to power its war machine? Synthetic oil from coal. And the process for doing that was literally given to them by Standard Oil. There's so many overlaps there that you cannot understand the Nazi regime and the rise of the Nazis without understanding those interlocks. And the fact that, like every other war that you could ever think of, every major confrontation in history, it's always funded on both sides by the banksters. And they get to choose which side gets a little bit more funding or a little bit more help in order to, you know, determine who ends up winning that conflict. But the idea that there was some virtuous Nazi regime that was fighting the bankers, even if they believed that, and I don't believe that they believe that, but even if you believe that they believe that, it still doesn't matter. They were still just being used as pawns.
Yeah, I think the ultimate takeaway is just that we're being lied to. And I think that's as broad as that is. It's like I apply that to what we're looking at today, say with like the Las Vegas thing, is if there's so much nonsense coming out and they want to keep you on the hook and they want to keep putting a new little pop out, the new you know, headline. It's like at some point you just got to stand back and say, look, we know they're lying to us. So why are we still pushing to find out that they are lying to us? It's like, you know, it's the ultimate takeaway. We know that they're lying. It's like once we figure that out, we should move to the next story. But yeah, I think that's pretty clear when you look through that history in itself, when you're talking about Germany or anything, like you said, it can kind of be superimposed on just about any historical war, whether it's funded on both sides. It's pretty blatant when you really know what you're looking for. And you have amazing research like yours, James, to check out. But, you know, really what we're talking about here, what you're boiling it down is kind of like the essential takeover of the country in one way or another. So at what point do you feel the oligarchy, which I love that term, by the way, was able to take over the U.S. government, if at all, as they did the education system and the medical industry? So at what point do you feel that happened?
That's a difficult question to answer so specifically. But I guess in the United States case, I mean, this is a global phenomenon, as I hope I portrayed in the documentary. But in the case specifically of the United States, I think we could look back to the testimony of Norman Dodd, which I did cite in How Big Oil Conquered the World, where he was talking about, for people who don't know, he was the lead researcher on the Rees Commission, which in the 1950s was looking into the tax-exempt foundations of these billionaire philanthropists and their legacy and what they were doing, and somehow or other managed to get access to the meeting minutes of the Carnegie Endowment from its very inception in the 1908, I believe. And so his researcher was going through and documenting what was in their meeting minutes from their first board meeting in 1908 and proceeding on through 1909. And as he said, they argued at great length and in a very intelligent and deliberative manner. They argued about what is the best way to change the consciousness, the perceptions of a society. Is there any way other than war that is more amenable to changing a society? And after a year of heady intellectual deliberations, they came to the conclusion that no, there is no way other than war that is more effective at changing a society's course. So from that point, as he says, they put their resources, their ideas towards how do we take over the foreign policy of the United States with the aim of directing it towards war. And so I think it was in that period specifically, around 1910, where you start to see the takeover of the apparatus of the U.S. State Department, and from there, the takeover of U.S. foreign policy. Of course, it also involved the Woodrow Wilson presidency, which, again, was kind of engineered into existence by the Bull Moose ticket, taking votes away from the Republicans in 1912 and ensuring that Wilson would get in, and Wilson, of course, being steered, puppeteered by Colonel Edward Mandel House, who, of course, then became an influential part of the Council on Foreign Relations founding, was intimately tied in with the J.P. Morgan syndicate, who itself was intimately tied in with the the Rothschild family. So there's this interlock. I mean, I'm using the frame of big oil and the oligarchy to look at this history, but you could equally look at the banking side of this, or you could look at it from other perspectives, because they all do overlap at some point. I mean, the Morgans and the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers at some point all merge into this, you know, Council on Foreign Relations, Bilderberg, whatever group that is the oligarchy in a certain sense, if you look at it from that perspective, or is the banking establishment. But I would say the 1910-ish is when the takeover really starts to happen in earnest. And you see that reflected most obviously in 1913, the passage of the Federal Reserve Act, the passage of the 16th Amendment that allowed for the direct tax on income. And then, of course, obviously the World War I breaks out in 1914, the U.S. becomes embroiled in it by 1917. Suddenly all of these congressmen and senators who had been so against the idea of an income tax were now saying, well, you know, we got to pay for the war, so, you know, let's increase it a little bit. And like that, exactly as the Carnegie Endowment talked about, society's perception, their understanding of the world can be changed through warfare. And it worked, I think, quite well on the American public, who still, even after World War One and after all of that indoctrination that had gone on in preparation, still were reticent to get involved in World War II. Americans still tended to see themselves as not, I don't want to use the word isolationist, because again, I think that doesn't capture the essence of it, but people who were happy to not be involved in foreign conflicts and entanglements like that. But where Pearl Harbor happens, and of course that changes. And from that point on, America as the policeman of the world has been the overriding mentality. So again, war causes that fundamental shift, and also the rise of the United Nations, donated on land, donated by the Rockefellers, of course.
Yeah, which is kind of why I brought up the U.S. specifically in that, because you definitely did. It's definitely very clearly a global problem in your documentary, is that, you know, the United States is kind of the pinnacle of the larger problem as it pertains to the geopolitical aspect. But, it's interesting, like you brought up the wartime taxes. That's one thing, going back to the first installment of the documentary, how they conquered the world. These taxes are very interesting, how it seems to play in where you're talking about the alcohol tax or the railroad tax, how each time it seems that was the reason they were able to push their product further ahead using these. And I often wonder, because it wasn't touched on, how those taxes in and of themselves might have been things that they started. And it's interesting to go, you know, kind of further go back. But interestingly enough, the going back to the time frame, which is why I asked the question, based on the information going through the documentary, it looks like it was, I think, 1946. You talked about the Edward J. Quimby article, and that rolls into when they were indicted on those charges. But then obviously they didn't get a real big punishment. So it looks like to me that that's kind of where that time was happening, where it seems we still had, you know, people trying to stop the problem, but then obviously there was only a $5,000 fine, so it didn't really happen. So that's kind of where I was looking at that time frame.
Right. Okay.
That was happening, or maybe the indictment was all a show. What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, certainly we can see from the punishment, quote unquote, that it was not a serious, it was not taken seriously by the legal system. But yeah, certainly in that era, I would say in every era, there are people, even people within the system, who are fighting against this agenda. I think the majority of people aren't necessarily on board with this agenda. They aren't themselves promoting this, whatever, eugenics or transhumanist or whatever agenda on their own behalf. They might be unwitting pawns in a much larger scheme. And I think there are people who get glimpses of this in every generation and try to warn people and try to blow the whistle. So I don't think that's necessarily just part of the 1940s or something. I don't think that ended at that period. And there are still people who are trying to blow the whistle on Agenda 21 or Agenda 2030 or whatever it's being called this week and other such things today. It's just a question of, will we listen to them or will they be treated like the Edwin J. Quimbys of our era?
Most definitely. There are always people within. I think that's something to remember, too, as negative as it can seem. I think today is probably one of the worst, you know, at least we always perceive our time to be probably one of the worst. But there are always people within that are actually trying to bring about positive change. That's always important to remember, because it can seem pretty damning when you start to see all of it as the problem, you know. So would you explain, for those that maybe haven't seen the documentary, the aspect — this is one of the most profound parts for me — the aspect of just how much of these, the you know, histories, innovations, and movements themselves, even in opposition, were created and even orchestrated by these groups?
Well, okay, that's a very broad topic. Do you have any specific aspects of that you'd like to look at? Education or?
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting when you kind of go through the information and start to realize that these different movements and different things, whether you're talking about, you know, GMOs or even movements to fight them, and these things that they are behind, just to touch on that aspect, because
yes,
it's so profound when people realize how much of that in the opposition, I would say, probably is the focal point for me.
Yes. Well, that is interesting. And in fact, one of the things that really stuck out when I was making How Big Oil Conquered the World was the takeover of the medical, not just the medical profession, but kind of the definition, that our understanding of what the medical profession is comes from the early 20th century and was shaped by Rockefeller researchers. That we don't really understand that from our perspective today. But in the late 19th century, there was still allopathic versus homeopathic medicine as two different paradigms that were both coexisting at that time. And different people preferred this or that for this or that ailment, or perhaps some people only trusted homeopaths, some people maybe only trusted allopaths. But there was a genuine bifurcation or a different idea of what medical profession even was at that time. And interestingly, John D. Rockefeller Sr. only wanted homeopathy. And he had an allopathic doctor that tried to come in and counsel him, and he just thought he was a quack. But it was his money through, with the help of Carnegie Foundation money, that Simon Flexner, who was a pathologist at the University of Pennsylvania, a professor, ended up writing what was called the Flexner Report. That was this report that was extremely influential in shaping the American medical college system. The idea that there would be these medical schools that doctors would have to go to get accredited by the then very recent AMA, the American Medical Association, which had also been started with the help of the Rockefellers. And that shaped the understanding of what is medicine and what is quackery. And medicine was giving out these pharmaceuticals, usually, you know, constructed and manufactured with the help of the petrochemicals, of course. And it's cut and burn, it's chemotherapy, for example, again, pioneered by a Rockefeller researcher from mustard gas research, interestingly. That is our understanding of medicine. And quackery is this, oh, you know, you take herbs and natural ingredients and things. Oh, that's just silly. You know, that's not what medicine is. And that understanding was 100% is a direct result of that shaping of the American medical profession that took place in that early 20th century, to the point where now most people, again, don't know that history existed. And they think that this just came out of the ether somewhere or something, where it's always been that way, or people just saw how much better allopathic medicine was and all just flocked to it. And how dare you suggest that chemotherapy isn't the best treatment for cancer. And now people are starting, I think, through the internet and through independent media, starting to discover that that may not be the best way of thinking about the profession of medicine. But it was absolutely from that period and from those forces. So that was one of those aspects that really stuck out for me. But I think in the Why Big Oil Conquered the World documentary, I think the overarching, I mean, the takeaway from that is really that the most effective opposition to big oil has come from the oligarchs. They have created and fostered into existence a movement, what started as the conservation movement and went through this overpopulation scaremongering movement into the modern environmental movement, which is focused laser-like on carbon dioxide, which even if you do take for granted the whole carbon dioxide, the greenhouse gases is the thermometer for the planet, which I obviously don't, but even if you do take that, carbon dioxide is itself a very small contributor to the greenhouse gas phenomenon, methane being by far a larger contributor. But people are focused on carbon dioxide to the point where it's just referred to as carbon. How much carbon can you emit? I mean, it's scientifically inaccurate to even use that phrase, but it's interesting that people's minds have been linked so that, of course, big oil is against this environmental movement because it's the exact polar opposite. It's going against the oil industry, of course. But the point that I'm trying to make, and I know it is counterintuitive and most people are encountering it for the first time are not quite going to get their heads around it. But no, the oligarchs are not the big oil companies anymore. Rockefeller family has literally divested, as of last year, divested all of their investments in oil. So they are no longer connected with oil, but they still have massive amounts of money and resources and wealth and power. And that is the point. As I say in the documentary, it was never about oil. It's not about oil per se. It was about what oil could achieve for these people. And as I say, oil, the consolidation of the monopoly around a key energy resource, was obviously an incredible font of wealth and power. But if you can get that wealth and power elsewhere, then it might serve your interest to create the opposition to the old industry that you pioneered so that you can transfer onto something new where you will have even more wealth and power if such a thing can be imagined. And that's where the technocracy aspect of this comes in. So I do see a clear historical line from eugenics to climate change to technocracy. But it's, again, it's so counterintuitive because people can't see that the opposition to the oil industry is being funded by the old oligarchs. That's so strange that most people really believe in their heart of hearts that they're fighting against the oil power structure when it's still the same people, but they're just changing the game.
Yeah, you would think that people would be a little bit more hip to it today, you know, with all the things that we're starting to kind of see and realizing that, you know, the whole controlled opposition term is kind of very, very, you know, recognized today. You'd think that we would start to see these things and for what they are. But yeah, definitely. Technocracy was the next aspect to get into here for me. And I honestly think that's something that a lot of people don't fully understand. They don't really grasp what that means and really just kind of see that kind of all mixed into one with just technology, right? That we're getting technologically advanced. And would you give a brief kind of overshot on what that really is? Like as it would pertain to people like us, like the dangerous aspects of it for people at home.
Well, the simplest definition, as Patrick Wood states in my documentary, he was the author of Technocracy Rising, which is I think, obviously the key book in relation to this, and really only came out very recently. So this is, again, another really interesting historical movement that still exists today, but most people have never even heard of. Technocracy was defined by the technocrats themselves in 1938 in their Technocrats magazine as a system for scientifically engineering society. And it was not just... It wasn't a scientific and technical thing. It wasn't an economic thing. It wasn't a social thing. It was all of these things combined. They believed that the answer to America's economic and social problems, and ultimately the world's, would come through scientific engineering of society. And it comes from this mindset of logical positivism and the work of Frederick Taylor and others that were at the turn of the century really revolutionizing people's ideas of, you know, the manufacturing industry and how we can automate various processes and how we can engineer everything, including the way that these factories are designed and everything, in order to make the workers in them more efficient and all of this. It was all about this kind of, how do we manipulate people as tools towards this greater end of achieving whatever it is we want to achieve, which of course was also what was used, for example, in the education system, to try to mold the children that were coming out as the products of this education system into more amenable workers for the industrial society that the oligarchs at that time wanted them to be. Well, in this case, they were looking at the kind of broader social and economic structure and saying, well, we can do the same thing. We can really shape and manage society by controlling it at... Ultimately, it came down, I think, fundamentally to the monetary system. And I think that is the way that society generally is engineered. So I think they were right about that. Their idea was to replace the current monetary system that we have with these dollars and cents with energy credits. And these energy credits would be issued by technocrats, these engineers who, you know, are scientifically minded and know what's best for society. And they would decide how much energy budget the nation should have based on production and consumption. And they would try to manage and balance that production with consumption so that it was perfectly balanced. So there would be no unemployment, there would be no overproduction and waste. It would just be perfectly balanced. It would be a harmonious system. They could do it because they're the engineers and they know how to calculate these things. All they would need is 24/7 surveillance of everything that's going on in the economy at all times. As long as they know every transaction of everything that's happening, then they can calculate it all with their, you know, amazing formulas, and won't it be a paradise? I think people can understand where this is going and why this might not be a good idea, because of course that is what every totalitarian tyrant in history has ever dreamed about, or even not dared to dream about, because it's so incredible to think about the idea of having that level of information and control over everything that's going on in a society. And when this, to be fair, when this idea was being talked about and codified in the 1930s by Howard Scott and, more importantly, M. King Hubbert of Hubbert's Peak, aka Peak Oil Theory, infamy, when it was being formulated in the 30s, it was crazy. It was an insane idea. It wouldn't have even been technically possible in anyone's wildest imagination. But fast forward 80, 90 years, and here we are. And it absolutely is possible to have that insight, that level of 24/7 surveillance of every transaction in society, and we are being engineered toward that, and exactly as the technocrats want. Now, of course, it isn't being called technocracy. The word has dropped out of use, but it is the same principles, and it is driven, I think, in the same fashion. There are these technocrats and engineers and researchers who really do believe, I think, genuinely believe, that they really can do this, and they are, you know, they have the technical expertise to be able to do this, and probably most of them generally are acting what they believe is in the interest of society. But once again, who is funding this work, and who is propelling it forward, and in what way is this coming about? Is this coming about through independent researchers, you know, carving it out from behind the scenes and working hard, or is it coming from major corporations and their, you know, billionaire banker backers? And unfortunately, of course, it's the latter. And we see the way in which this smart home, smart grid, smart everything universe is being engineered so that we will all be 24/7 surveilled in the near future, if we aren't already.
Yeah, that's definitely the sad aspect of this, is that far too many people, there are far too many that tend to lead these movements thinking they're doing something altruistic or doing something positive, when really it ultimately benefits the few at the top who are ultimately, you know, I mean, we see that throughout history, and especially when in this topic, that they lead people on some moral quest when in reality they're just pulling the strings to be able to accomplish what they want. It's frustrating, but yeah, it's definitely something we're seeing that very much applies to what we're seeing today. Where's the logical connection between technocracy and eugenics?
Well, on an operational level, I think we see the same dynamic playing out between scientific researchers in the late 19th century who, again, genuinely believed that they were, I mean, I don't think they were doing it for an agenda per se, or at least not a conscious agenda. They were genuinely researching into this new field of heredity, and, oh, there are these hereditary things that, and we're trying to work out the principles of it, and, well, this must apply to human populations and social Darwinism and all of this coming together at the same time as you had this industrial revolution that was revolutionizing people's understanding of what was possible in terms of engineering human society. Oh, can we engineer the race? Can we engineer genes? So you had these researchers that were working on what at the time were genuine scientific ideas and problems. And unfortunately, they tended to go down pseudoscientific roads in pursuit of that. But at any rate, I think most of the researchers genuinely were doing it, from a space where they weren't part of knowing parts of some sort of agenda, but they were being funded, of course, by the billionaire philanthropists who, of course, were using it for their own aims and purposes, because, of course, they were the genetic superior. I mean, clearly, they're the billionaires, so they must be superior. So, of course, it's kind of a latching on, parasitical, to something that was organically developing. And in the same way with the environmental movement and climate change and all that, again, there is an organic environmental movement that people do feel concerned about the ways that the world is being raped and pillaged by the oligarchs and their ilk. So, of course, they create and literally create all of the major institutions that we know of in the environmental movement, the World Wildlife Fund and the IUCN and UNEP, and all of these bodies have been created literally by the oligarchs and eugenicists and people who literally served on the Eugenic Society board. I mean, this isn't conspiracy theorizing. These are genuine linkages. Julian Huxley, a president of the British Eugenic Society, founded the IUCN there at the founding of the WWF. All of these linkages exist and are right there in our face if we just stare at them. And then with the technocrats, again, I think it's the same phenomenon. You have these engineers and scientists who, again, genuinely believe that they're creating this system that they think, we can do this and we can manage for the best of society. But again, it's being latched onto parasitically by a ruling oligarch class that wants to steer that in a certain direction. So I think in all of those cases, it's the same phenomenon that's happening over and over. And in all of the cases, it's just a question of, well, yeah, we can steer this towards ultimate centralization of control. And ultimately, I think the long-term plan, which I didn't really get into in the documentary, but I think the long-term plan is some sort of transhumanist sort of thing where it's going to be literally, I mean, they're going to actually enact this genetic superiority, inferiority thing through genetic engineering. It will be a genetically engineered superior class that will obviously be the people who have the resources to do that. And then the genetically inferior class that will, as Bertrand Russell said back in, I can't remember the name of the book off the top of my head, but he said there that eventually the idea of trying to overthrow this ruling class, this scientifically enabled ruling class, will be as ridiculous as the idea of mutton, sheep banding together to overthrow the practice of eating mutton. It will be impossible. And we saw that, of course, in Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. That's what that was about. The alphas and the betas and the thetas and whatever, the different classes of society that are engineered from birth or birth hatching in their incubators. That these people have been created to be this certain class of, you know, slave-like labor or whatever it is. And I think that's the direction that this is going. That sounded like crazy science fiction, you know, fantasy nonsense a century ago. It's really coming into view. And we would have to be willfully ignorant not to see the direction that this is trending and not to have some concern about it. I mean, maybe it won't end up that way. And I hope it won't. And I think we can throw monkey wrenches and try to, you know, steer this in a different direction. But unless we face the fact that that's where this is heading, what hope do we have?
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, I would take that a step further and even say, you know, pose the idea that we are already that, you know, we are this orchestrated, manipulated group. And the more of the testament of that is that we don't even know, really the point is that we're completely unaware of this manipulation. You know, you can call it, you know, this, you know, the soft World War III. There's a lot of different theories of the idea that it's going to have war on us. That's been going on for a long time, but clearly that we're being manipulated and we just don't see it. I mean, I'd like to think more do than don't, but I think one of the most alarming aspects of what we're touching on right there is this ability to kind of circumvent these institutions or schools and kind of get behind them and create the curriculum. And that's just so profound to really think about. And it's because, you know, these conspiracy theories to a lot of people are easily dismissed because they say, why would they do that? But when you really begin to realize that these doctors believe they're doing the right thing, right? When these people believe because they were taught by people that are creating that, It's alarming. And we begin to see the larger picture that, that your documentary very clearly lays out. It's very alarming, but we have to begin to see these things. You know, there's really no progress unless we begin to acknowledge them.
That's right.
Is there, if there's one thing that you could say to the average listener to kind of take away with this and to do, like say someone that has never seen this before, that is just completely blown away by this. And, you know, before they run away and can forget it all, one thing they could do to cause small change in their daily life right now.
Well, I think the revolution of consciousness, as I've said before, is the only revolution that fundamentally matters, because you're exactly right. The takeover of education indoctrination for generations, to the point where no one in living memory probably remembers a point before this takeover happened, is so complete. It's so incredibly totalitarian, but not in that sense. But anyway, it's such a totality that it's difficult to even begin to step away and observe it and see it for what it is. So I think cognitive independence is absolutely what we should be aiming at. And any way we can use to get there is to the good. So we have to deprogram ourselves from the way we've been programmed. And you bring up the education system, and it's not just the curriculum. The curriculum is the software. It's the hardware. It's the format of the way that we have been taught to operate since the time we were children. You stand in lines, you raise your hand when you want to talk, you go to the rhythm of the school bell, all of these things is drummed into you from the time you were born, that there is a certain order to this and a certain way you have to do this, and you have to conform to these strictures. So deprogramming ourselves from that is such an incredibly overwhelming thing. Something that it often comes back down to for me as the first step, which sounds so unimportant that I think most people will dismiss it immediately, but I think it's not for everyone, but I think for some people can be a way of trying to break out of that, is to go into your backyard, dig up a little bit of the grass that you probably have growing there, and grow a plant. Grow something that you can eventually eat yourself with your own hands. Get your hands dirty and do that. And I think that's a revolutionary act in a number of different ways. Of course, it's revolutionary in the sense that we are running into the era where heirloom seeds and non-GMO products will be more and more difficult to find and source. Unless you're growing it yourself, you certainly can't be certain that what you're eating hasn't been tainted by GMOs. And in fact, probably everyone, including myself and yourself and everyone who's listening to this, no matter how careful you are, you're going to be consuming genetically modified products at some point. Well, one way we can start to take back our independence is through food independence. And that is something that literally, and it's also consciously revolutionary act as well, because the idea that has been drummed out of us is that our connection to the world around us is direct and is natural, that the world itself is abundant, and what we need is there. We might have to work for it, but we can do it with our own bare hands, and we can create what we need to survive. Is an important thing to understand for a society that has now been so conditioned into, I'm hungry, let's go to the supermarket. I'm hungry, I'll go to the restaurant. We have to start reconnecting with nature itself, with the world around us, and realizing we can do things, physical things in the real world, and create real effects. Again, we're getting more and more disconnected with all of this as so much of our lives are now mediated through screens, and we're less and less, we're more and more observers of the world and less participants in it. So again, just a simple act like creating a little garden in your backyard can be the consciousness trigger to get people to see that. Again, it's not for everyone that has to be gardening, but anything you can do that starts to deprogram you from all of those systems of control is to the better. And for some people, that's going to be things like, I know that one of my listeners is technologically inclined, is a coder, and had been listening to my program for a number of years and heard me ringing the alarm bell over and over and over about exactly what we're seeing now with the Google crackdown and altering algorithms so you can't find alternative information and all of this. And he saw that and saw what was happening with YouTube and created BitChute.com, an alternative peer-to-peer decentralized video sharing platform that is an alternative to YouTube. Excellent. Wonderful. That's it. we can do these things. We can figure out how to create our own infrastructure, but it is work. It is a task. It's not going to be easy. And I can't guarantee success overnight or anything of that sort. But unless everyone who's listening to this finds that thing, whatever it is they can do, and go out there and start doing it, then we'll never get out of this. And it won't come from me. It won't come from you. It will come from all of us taking whatever we do, because each one of us has our own talents and skills and gifts. And if mine is communication, then I'm happy to use that in service of the greater agenda of freeing humanity in some sense, cognitively, and doing my small part in that greater task. And that's it. There's no easy answer to that, because everyone has their own gifts and talents and whatever it is they can do. But if everyone starts doing what they can do and getting their hands dirty, metaphorically or literally, then I think we can start to counteract this agenda, which so much relies on us just going along to get along, just being passive participants in the world, passive observers of the world, rather than active participants.
I absolutely love that. That's fantastic. I mean, it's, you know, you definitely need to learn that we can do things without the, you know, falsely loving arm of this falsely benevolent government that we have. I mean, that's kind of the thing, is we've been manipulated into thinking that we need them for just about every little thing throughout our lives. I think I even heard you say this in the past, but the idea that classic line, like, oh, well, who's going to build the roads? Like, the same people. Yeah.
We will. Exactly.
Yeah. All still there. But yeah, I love that. I mean, there's small little things like that we really need to remember, and we need to start doing things for ourselves. But we also need to start standing back, taking information like this, and really beginning to digest it and understand that these people, be it the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, whatever group we're discussing, they are masters at rebranding themselves, at recreating what they present to you. So you see them as something else. So you continue on with this agenda in another way. And they also are masters at pulling your heartstrings and your moral, and, you know, what they convince you into thinking that you're doing something for a just cause, when really you're just helping them suit their agenda.
And actually, you just fired an idea in my mind, so let me leave people with this, perhaps. The idea that you just put out, oh yeah, well, what about the roads? Of course, the first question everyone hears when they start questioning some of these systems of control, and oh, well, we need government to go bomb people on the other side of the planet, because what would we do without them? How would we build the roads? Isn't it interesting, as I go through and how big oil conquered the world, that the interstate system, the highway system, that really created the car culture, that really fostered that car culture that is now seen as an integral, fundamental part of American culture, it was really cemented into place in the 1950s, at the time when the head of the Department of Defense, who spearheaded the project, just happened to be, oh, a former GM executive. Huh, funny how that works. So that the idea of the roads as being fundamental to our society, itself was shaped as part of this agenda. And now people take it so on board that this is the first thing that they think of when they think about stepping outside of the box or stepping outside of those bounds of control. But what about the roads? Roads, where we're going, we don't need roads. People have to start understanding that even what they want, even what they desire, even what they think is necessary itself has been shaped as part of this agenda. And until we start thinking outside that box and thinking, well, maybe we can construct a society where we don't need massive road infrastructure in order to, you know, so we can take our car down the street to go to a convenience store to get our quart of milk or whatever. Maybe that is this insane and unhealthy and stupid way of organizing society that only came about as part of the manipulation of our minds. And maybe when we're free human beings interacting voluntarily with each other, we can think of better ways of organizing our society that don't even involve that type of organization and infrastructure. So I think that might be one way to look at this greater problem, is that even what we think we want may itself be part of this agenda.
Excellent words to leave us on, James. I appreciate you joining us today.
Absolutely. Well, anytime you need me. And if you send me a link, I'll definitely let my audience know about it.
Absolutely. Well, stay vigilant out there. Follow the change. Be the change.
Big oil. Big pharma. Genetic engineering. The green revolution. The environmental movement. Eugenics. Technocracy. Not one person in 1,000 can detail the historical development of these ideas, or the people and the agenda that connects them. But if you have watched this documentary, you are now that one person in 1,000. The question is, what are you going to do with this information?